Welcome to Deep Dive Genre. Zamrin Wadad was born in 1989 in Kabul, Afghanistan. She was just 2 years old when the family decided to leave the country due to the political situation, eventually finding a new home in Hamburg, Germany. After graduating from high school, Zamrin found it difficult to see her professional future in Germany. There was simply a lack of representative figures in the German film industry. So she went to Brighton, to the School of Media, Film and Music at the University of Sussex, graduating with a bachelor's degree in 2012. During this time, she also made her first short film, in which she was involved as a screenwriter and visual designer. At NYU's Tisch School of the Arts in New York, where Zamrin pursued her master's degree, image design and screenwriting were her majors. Her professor approached Zamrin during this time and asked her to work as an image designer and translator on her documentary short film, Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, If You're a Girl. Zamrin traveled back to Afghanistan a short time later for the first time since her family fled. In 2020, the team of Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, If You're a Girl, received the Oscar for Best Documentary Short Film. Zamrin's directorial debut followed in the same year, the short film Bambirak. It won the award for Best International Short Film at the 2020 Sundance Film Festival. Currently, Zamrin is developing this personal story into a 90-minute feature film, which will be set in Hamburg and is planned as a German-French co-production. She's also part of German Film's Face-to-Face Campaign 2022. We talked to Zamrin via video call for this interview. Hi, Zamrin. It's a pleasure to talk to you. We would like to talk to you about the film Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, If You're a Girl, for which you received the Oscar in 2020, and which sadly is even more current now, but also have an overall conversation with you about your work behind the camera as a cinematographer and as a director. Over the course of your career so far, you've been behind the camera on a variety of films, but today's focus, for the most part, is on films that deal with the portrayal of war and armed conflict. I know it's been a while since, you know, you filmed Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, but I was just wondering if you could take our listeners through the process of what the first steps were when you started working on this project.
So yeah, we filmed Learning to Skate in a War Zone 2017. We went to Afghanistan to actually film twice. And I got on board on this project as an additional cinematographer and also translator and interpreter while I was a student at the NYU Film School. And I had a professor there who was focusing on Afghanistan in general. Like, she made a documentary about Afghanistan 6 years ago, which received an Oscar as well. And she spent a lot of time in Afghanistan in the military documenting a friendship. And when she found out about me, she immediately reached out and I started to work for her to translate her new documentary, which is not Learning to Skate in a War Zone. But I was like her translator of the raw footage of the documentary and got to know her. And in my final year, she was like, Zama, do you want to go to Afghanistan? And I was like completely perplexed because it was not what I expected. I was not expecting to, in my university time, to be able to travel to Afghanistan. It was always a dream of mine because I was born there. My parents are from there. But I didn't think that it will happen so soon. And of course I said yes straight away because I didn't even think. I was like, yes, I want to, and I want to work in film, and I want to support you in the project. But I wasn't finished with uni yet. So not telling my university and keeping it more secret because it's not like a safe, it wasn't a safe country in 2017, safer than now maybe, but like it was always a war zone. But I still said yes, yeah, and had to tell my family, which was a big process because as an Afghan family, you don't just tell your parents or ask your parents, even though you are grown up, but you also have to tell your extended family, which is kind of, it's just trusting them and not having them freak out or fear for your life, which they all did.
Yeah,
I went anyways and accepted that my mom cried and that my sister was a bit mad at me that I didn't tell her. For me, it was more difficult to tell it to the people who were closest to me than to the people who were a bit further away, because I knew they will get very emotional. It will hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
But I went anyways. And that's how it started. Like, it was just starting to work for my professor as a translator. And then she kept me in mind and took me with her to Afghanistan.
If I'm not mistaken, the crew consisted almost entirely of women, except for a local fixer that you worked with?
Yes, exactly. The producer was a female from Grain Media in the UK. The DP, Lisa Rinsler, was a very experienced DP, Carol Deisinger, and me, and Tamana, who's now living in London after leaving Afghanistan in 2021. She was also like female assistant and me. So we were all female except of our fixer, because obviously as a fixer in Afghanistan, you have to be male.
Obviously, given your special situation, you know, having been born in Afghanistan and leaving the country when you were, I think, 2 years old, if I'm correct. Everybody else were outsiders, Westerners. But you were, as you mentioned, you were translating, so you were a very essential part of the film crew. And I think you were also the only one who could communicate directly to the girls. And I was wondering, was that particularly hard for you, you know, in regards to maybe keeping a distance and keeping a neutral look?
It was not hard per se, because they were really inviting for the film crew. Like, it didn't feel like on another documentary where you feel you overstep your boundaries and where's the line where you have to stop pushing. They were really open. That made it so much easier to talk to them. I developed a closer relationship to them, which went beyond that of just filming. And I also started to care about the girls and to care about the teachers who were talking to me and telling me what they didn't want to show their face, for instance, one of them, even though she was very modern. And I was like communicating their wishes to the film team, like to the director and to the producer, like, and these are the things we can do in order to make them feel comfortable in front of the camera. And with the girls, especially because they just spoke Dari. And also I was younger, so it's easier to connect to a younger person than to an over 60-year-old. I was working with Carol Deisinger, took her questions and translated them and then asked the girls, but also went off her questions and reacted to what the girls were telling me. And I gave them a homework to draw something for me and come back the next day. And that helped kind of to break the ice and be playful and gain their trust and friendship in a way. So even though we filmed in a war zone, the surrounding was difficult, of course, getting from the hotel safely to the skate school, not putting any attention on us entering the school. That was very important for them. But as soon as we were through the gates, through security, they were so, so open to share, to just share their life, let us be there with lunch from the morning till the evening, really.
When I started researching the focus for this season for the podcast, I quickly realized that there's two possibilities usually films go. Either it's all about the blood and gore of the, you know, the battlefield, which means it's mostly male protagonists. And then, you know, you have films dealing mainly with the side and after effects of these battles, showing mainly women holding life and communities together. Drawing on the work that you guys did on learning to skate, what was, in your experience, or what do you remember maybe being the hardest part to show in regards to the violence and the conflict in the documentary, and maybe juxtaposing it with sort of the hope that the girls have when they skate?
Actually, there was one situation because we went outside the school as well, which was the toughest parts to film. We went to the families' homes. We always had a fixer who was standing and looking if people are coming and when the situation gets dangerous for the family and us. Once we went to the house of one of the kids, one of the, she was a really bright kid, and she had a mom and like she had like six siblings, and one of them was really small and like a boy, very, very angry and like full of energy, kind of like he was 2 years old, but he had like he wanted attention. And then when we did the interview, the mom suddenly started to look at me. We didn't cut it into the movie, but she looked at me. She's like, "Can you please adopt my child and take her with you to Germany? She will have such a better future there. There's no future here for her." It broke my heart. I was like, I would, like, this is the reality, right? Like, the mothers grew up during the Taliban time. So for them, they didn't grow up with the freedom their kids had in 2017. Mm-hmm. And the same situation happened in the house of Hanifa and Shogofa, who were the skating teachers, 15 and 18. And the mom, where she said, "You know, like when I grew up, there was war, but I'm so happy that my children can do anything they want and that they're living in peaceful times and can become doctors or can then sustain our family." And I was like, yeah, for that, back then I felt like, oh God, for her, this situation in Afghanistan right now is not war, but peace, because she lived under the Taliban. And now thinking about it, they're back under the Taliban. The school is closed. The girls cannot do sports anymore or go to school. And it was a really, like thinking about it now, it's even then it was not easy for me to listen to it and realizing what actually, how it is to grow up in Afghanistan, to be a woman in Afghanistan, but face, like looking at it now, it's even harder to process.
Yeah. You know, if you think about what their everyday life looks like, what a different reality they live in and what they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, sort of juxtaposing documentaries and fictional portrayals of war and conflict in movies. Obviously, fictional works often use a certain dramatic setting, music. Would you say, from your experience, is it harder to film and show violence or armed conflict in a documentary?
Yeah, I think it's definitely much harder. Of course, when the actors do such a good job and it feels really, you're really emotionally attached to it. But in the same time, you know, this is all not reality that's happening in front of you. And in documentary, it is real. But it's the same thing as photojournalist face, right? When you are a war photographer, when do you put the camera down? And when do you document it? Because your job is kind of to show the world what's happening and to document it so everyone can see what is happening in the country. But in the same time, you are ethically in such a dilemma because you are just thinking this is a real person. Something is happening to them right now. They live miserable lives and somehow they don't want you to film. I had this situation in Camp Moria, where I was filming a documentary, Life's Not Great, which is last year won, I think, an Emmy for independent documentary. And there it was for me much harder to film because the people didn't want you there. I heard a lot of Afghani people. I felt ashamed, mm-hmm. honestly, that I'm holding a camera and I'm shooting how they live.
Yeah, that you're intruding maybe somehow in there.
And it's always like and you have in your mind, okay, you could actually be the one who maybe volunteers or does something that really like helps them now instead of filming it because it feels very voyeuristic. But in the same time, you're there to actually capture the footage to show what's going on in that camp because otherwise people won't know. It's not easy. That's why doing fiction for me is much easier than doing documentaries because you go to bed and you think about it and it doesn't, you can't let go, right? Because they're real people.
Yeah. You're working both in fiction and documentary, and you also work both as a cinematographer and a director. What are certain aspects that you enjoy about each of the respective jobs and genres?
I mean, I kind of have to clarify that I only for now directed one short film that went to major festivals and had a good run and wrote and directed it. I did some at uni, but for me, those don't count because everyone had to do it and everyone, it just stays within the uni walls.
Yeah.
So I don't consider myself yet a director who directs a lot of things. Like I get requests, but I think I do in directing, like right now I'm working on a feature film of mine, which I write and direct, where I feel confident because it's my work that I can do well or mess up, but it's not the work of a writer or like a company that, who hired me as a director. Because I don't have a lot of practice in directing. Like I did a lot of theater at school, studied a bit of drama, but still like you have to hone the craft. But in the same time, my work as a cinematographer helps me to watch directors and learn from different directors what their methods are, how they're working, how they go about each scene, which comes to cinematography because I was always a very visual person. Taking that side away from like from me, because I think in images, and when someone tells me a story, I immediately have an image and an action for it in my mind. For me, it's much easier to communicate in images than with words. That's why I was always drawn to cinematography, which combines kind of telling a story through images or helping. And when you find the right director, it's like magic. It becomes my own film. Like whenever I take on a project, it's a burden maybe, but also it's a blessing. I dive in so much and do so much research, spend a lot of time with the director. I kind of want to be immersed in the world and create those images for that story, and I get really excited. So I think personally, my preference, right, of course, because I'm also more, now I did it often, I love to work with directors and collaborate with them. And I love the visual side of it and my camera and gaffing team. I enjoy it. I gain energy, even though it's tiring, the work as a cinematographer. Whereas as a director, I think what I'm missing is the experience to go as effortlessly through it like I do in cinematography because I'm more used to it. As a cinematographer, I focus on this side. I think about the story. It's mostly creative. It's management, but it's creative too. As a director, doing one short film or like watching all the other directors I've worked with, you have the whole pack. So you're not just dealing on the story, you're dealing with the finances, you're dealing with the production. And it's a lot. It's like a lot of bureaucracy as well as a director. And so I think like if I have to choose, if I really, really have to choose forever, and I cannot step back just one thing, it would be cinematography.
Okay, well, we certainly won't make you choose.
But like that's like just the ultimate choose.
Talking about cinematography, a lot of cinematographers or people behind the camera are men. And that might have something to do with maybe the physicality of the job. Given the changes and the innovations regarding camera equipment, as well as the slowly changing industry landscape, is that something in your experience over maybe the last few years that is slowly changing?
I think the directing world is changing as fast as the cinematography world. Like the same for directors, with so many male directors and rarely female directors. The landscape of filmmaking is changing in general. And the technology might have to do something with it because cheaper equipment, which delivers high quality, becomes more accessible to young people and to females as well as males. So that's why the females don't need to be hired by anyone, but can just take it and create their own work. Anyhow, there's still more male cinematographers around. And I had the experience that people trust men more in that role, which is, I don't know where it comes from, maybe because they're not used to a different situation. I had a situation that explains it quite well. I was at an event and I met this director who really wanted to meet me, talented, really nice. And she suddenly says, well, yeah, you know, I don't know if I can work with a female cinematographer because, you know, female people like they talk so much. Like, look at the hair and makeup department. I was stunned. I looked at her. I was like,
what kind of a statement is that?
Look at the hair and makeup department. That's their job. And look at the men who work at the hair and makeup department. They talk as much as the female because they need to. They need to talk to the actors. Otherwise, it will become very robotic doing their jobs.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I used myself, it's like, I don't talk a lot behind the camera when I'm shooting because how could I? Like, it's not possible.
Yeah.
And I don't chit chat as well. Like, it's not my job description. And she looked at me, she was like, oh, I never thought about it this way. And I was really, I was like, okay, there's still a lot of work to do to break down those stereotypes. But thank God, like, I just joined Cinematografinnen in Germany. And also the International Female Collective of Cinematographers. I meet so many talented female cinematographers who support each other and who recommend each other to other shows and films. And this is actually how I get my jobs. I get it through word of mouth by mostly female people, like female directors or cinematographers recommending me. And that's why the landscape is changing, because we give each other the opportunities.
Talking strictly the job of cinematography now, what was your biggest work challenge in regards to maybe shooting a scene or dealing with, the equipment or setup?
That's a very interesting question because, of course, like, I would think about documentary now because I faced most of my trouble in that, like most of the most difficult scenes.
Yeah.
Whereas in fiction, it's a bit of a different problem. So I think my biggest challenge as a shooter was when I was working on this, on another documentary, which is called Long Distance Swimmer, Sarah Mardini, and it will come out next year. And that was difficult because we were shooting during Corona times and the director was living in London and I was in Hamburg. So I could travel at points when you could travel in Germany for work to Berlin and back. But it meant I have to travel without her and do the documentary without her. And she was just there remotely or briefing me and doing the interviews over Zoom. It was just me and the sound person. We had really little equipment because that was the nature of the documentary. Also for our subject to be as small as possible. Work always with natural light. But it was more the nature of, okay, now the responsibility. I don't have a director who can like guide me through it or take the subject's attention. And suddenly I was the one.
Yeah, you were front and center, basically.
Exactly, which is in documentary, you want to be a fly on the wall and you don't want to be looked at. But in the same time, she looked at me. So it was always like a fine balance and also deciding when am I overstepping, when I have to stop the shoot, even though the production is pushing me. Mm-hmm. Emotionally, that was the most difficult. Like technically, it was okay because that's what we had, a small camera and available light. But yeah, that was a strong learning experience for me in general. But in fiction, I think maybe the most recent I did where we were working in Canada and we did a coming of age horror film, which is the first time I actually did genre behind the camera. And produced by Una Film in from Hamburg and Elevation in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it was the first independent feature that I did on a bigger budget and not like as a very independent film and with a bigger crew. But still, given that fact that we had a bigger budget, it was too low to get everything you needed in order to make the look work. So we had just this one giant big light we had to set up on a crane, and I had an amazing team of key grip and gaffer who helped me actually to brainstorm this because I never worked on that scale before. Like I never worked to light a pitch dark forest or to light a pitch dark field. And we had this really big balloon which we put up like 100 meters. We're lighting 150, I don't remember, like we're lighting from top above. But we had to, because we had two cameras and we were tight on time, we had to prepare the B camera on the field so the actors can run to the B camera after we're done with that scene. Mm-hmm. Because they were both minors and they had to go home. There was no way around.
Yeah, they had only a certain amount
of time. Exactly. It was so hard to find the right position. And then we move the light like twice around in order to make it work, which took so much time. But in the end, we made a compromise and changed like the location of the forest more to the front. So because it was dark and no one saw anything and the light reaches, that was quite challenging, a technical challenge, which in the end we managed to do, but it was tough.
Yeah. What would you say is maybe the biggest misconception about the work of cinematographers?
I had this conversation just yesterday at the Lüneburg Film Festival.
Okay.
I was talking to a director and I was like, yeah, it is insane that people think that the cinematographer comes to set, puts the camera up and just presses a button. That's literally what, not filmmakers, they know, like directors, filmmakers, they all know. But people who are not in film think, oh, well, but you just have to put up the camera and press record, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, I wish it would be that easy. And you don't do all the prep work and think about lights and think about how to convey a story. But that's the biggest misconception I feel for people who are not working in film, what they think what the cinematographer does. They don't know how much they're involved in the creation of the image, how much time they spend with the scripts and the director, and like getting to know them, coming up with a visual concept if the director doesn't have one, or adding to their concept and making all these floor plans and lighting plans. And it's a lot of prep work. I think cinematography is actually happening in prep. That's why it looks so effortless when you're on set and you just come on and press the button.
Yeah. And in light of what you said earlier about that situation of figuring out the lighting, you know, also a cinematographer has to know what is doable and what isn't doable. That hopefully saves a lot of money.
A cinematographer also works within their budgets, right? You can shoot a film that way if you have those lights, or you have to scout smartly and shoot close to a window during the day and position the actors there so you get natural light, like, and time it well. The budget really is also influencing the way you shoot your film. Mm-hmm. And I think the management side of cinematography, people also don't see. Yeah. You have to think the whole time and constantly making compromises, because as a cinematographer, you do as well. You do it because of time constriction, because of light restrictions. You are a problem solver, but at the same time, you want to push for the right scenes and right moments where you know that everyone's going to be so sad if this is not properly done. And it's kind of the berries of the movie, you know, pick your berries, fight for them, and the rest make compromises. That's kind of my way of approaching films.
And you sort of touched on that a little bit earlier, being both a director and a cinematographer, has filling both positions at certain times changed your perspective on the jobs respectively? Has it helped your work maybe that you essentially know how to wear two hats?
Definitely. And that's how I was taught too. I went to NYU and you have to, in your first year, fulfill every position. Oh. You even have to edit your own stuff. You write, you direct, you shoot, you edit. You even have acting classes. And I feel like
it's like a boot camp.
It's definitely a boot camp. And then within each year, you kind of choose your profession more and more. Mm-hmm. But I'm so grateful that I went through that boot camp. For instance, the acting classes. Who would think a cinematographer is taking acting classes? But it's because you, even now, like now that I'm a few years off school, I kind of realize sometimes I look at an actor, but I look at the light on their face, mm-hmm. and the professional, like the actors who are a bit more experienced, they know what I'm looking at and they don't get irritated. But sometimes, like when you have a new actor or like a child actor, they look at you and you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just looking at the light, how it falls on your face, like communication, that you don't push them around. They're like human beings who are in front of your camera. And the same for the director, how much pressure they have. My gaffing department doesn't know, my key grip department doesn't mm-hmm. know, but I should know, because I'm protecting them and keeping my crew on the director's side. Because sometimes the scene takes longer and they do one more take and everyone's like, why do they do one more take? And you're like, well, because this is what we want to achieve and we didn't get it. It's just good to have the knowledge of how each department works, mm-hmm. especially editing for cinematographers as well. Having to edit my own work at university and seeing, okay, should I was paying too much attention on a beautiful frame and didn't get that shot, which I really needed to tell my story. So I didn't have a story. I had to cheat and punch in. Knowing that, you go into the shoot always thinking while you're shooting about the edit and prioritizing the story. And like, oh no, you need the face, you need the reaction, and not spending too much time on creating the perfect image, because the perfect image doesn't exist.
As a director and also as a cinematographer, how do you choose your projects?
That's a really good question. Usually, right now I've shot short films. I've shot so many different short films. And there I even worked with directors on scripts that weren't ready yet, but I was like confident while working together, they will get ready. Which is also different on shorts, when you trust the director and you know them. And of course, I had the privilege to know them because I went to film school. So you choose more the director you believe in and you like their vision, and together you create and you trust the process. Yeah. You trust it's going to be fine. But now, like later in the stage, when it comes then to features, and even now with short stories, and I don't know the director, it's first... If I like the story and the script and I can identify with it and something inspires me about it,
yeah,
and the approach inspires me, then I'm interested and I want to kind of meet the director and work with them. But usually in the end, it's the script, definitely. And it's about the director too. Mm-hmm. When I meet the director and I think, okay, we're on the same page as well, like I like the script or I think it's gonna get really good, and then it clicks with the director and you share the same vision or the same work ethic, then that's like, that counts even more than the script, because then you kind of, you know, it's gonna be a good relationship. Working with a director is marrying one for a certain amount of time, because you spend more time with them than with your partner. But it all starts in fiction, it all starts with the script.
Has your appreciation for your work, for your job, changed over the course of the past few years? You know, the projects that you've done, the people that you've met, and maybe also the changes in the film industry.
Yeah. Do you mean that I am kind of am thankful for my job, or like...
Yes, or maybe the way you see your job also, you know, does it feel different to you maybe than when you initially started out?
Yeah, I mean, when I started out, it was quite... The projects were smaller, creatively more free, and you had much more creative freedom, but less possibilities, if I can put it that way, right? Because you have to just create with the tools that are around. But during the process, coming from independent short films to especially TV shows, that was a huge jump for me.
Yeah.
Suddenly I had a crew of 30, 40 people on the set, but I had a crew of 10 or 15. And for me, it was like, okay, what am I doing with so many people? And then suddenly I actually started to appreciate the departments much more, because I knew if you choose your gaffer and your key grip and your first AC smartly, they will take on so much workload of you, so you focus on the creative side. And I started to appreciate the departments much more, because I finally like had departments. Before, it was like, as a student, oh, I can gaff a little bit, like it was more like that. But this was like really working with professionals, and I started to admire each one of them and to appreciate them so much. Yeah, and working on a scale like that and fast as that, you need them. You need your crew, because the crew makes, especially when you have a good gaffer, they make your film so much better, because they can think constantly about light and find solutions with you. And they are much better in lighting than you are, because they do it constantly on every set. So you learn from them a lot,
yeah.
And you'll take that knowledge with you to the next set, or hopefully the gaffer with you to the next set. Yeah, my appreciation for like also other cinematographers, like looking at me, it's kind of weird, but looking at other cinematographers, I was like, really grew as the scale of the projects I was doing grew.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, for our last question, I was wondering if you can share which projects you're currently working on and maybe are coming up in the next few months.
So one of them I already mentioned, a project I've been involved in since 2019 with Charlie Feldman and produced by Dog Days. It's long distance swimmer Sarah Mardini.
Yeah.
Following Sarah Mardini over the course of 5 years from her journey to Berlin and after she got imprisoned, actually. Like,
okay.
The moment between the prison and the trial she is facing, or still is facing, actually. That is the one that will come out next March.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's another one, which I just fiction, completely opposite, which I shot in Canada, the coming-of-age horror movie,
mm-hmm.
which is set in Canada, which I shot with a Canadian director who lives in Hamburg. Her name is Carly Bockstrom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also coming, and they're both going through festival runs. So okay. First it's festival run, and then let's see what happens.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed. And Zamarine, thank you so much for talking to us today. It was a real pleasure, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Deep Dive Genre is produced by German Films, the National Information and Advisory Center for the Promotion of German Films Worldwide. To find out more about our guests, check out the links in our show notes. To stay up to date with our episodes, subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.